Good appetites, I should say, since this is the Black Bond lunch. Of course, I would also like to take this chance to thank the organizers for the opportunity of being here. It's very stimulating to be at the RDP this fall. And well, when I was asked to give this presentation, I first was tempted to really try to give you a sense of what is going on in the developmental neuroscience of vision, because this is, depending on how you view it, you could say that this is a field in a crisis, because the biologists can lose their way in the data every year. On the other hand, you could say that this is a very promising field because there are so many puzzles to be resolved, and it takes a physicist's mind to maybe find these ways in the right fashion. But then I realized this would really exacerbate in one of these marathon events that have become the hallmark of the neuroscience program. So it doesn't work. Instead, what I would like to present to you is, first of all, give you the best evidence there is that when you acquire the ability to see as an infant, this is actually a learning process, and we should not falter in believing that this is a learning process, whatever turns up in the brain as final observations. And then concentrate on one single problem, which is the development of orientation preference, the basic organization of the visual centers of the brain that enables you to detect contours of different orientation and which forms the basis of form vision. Yeah. All the objects you see, this blackboard in particular, that stick, are made up of contours, and if you were not able to detect contours, all the rest of vision did not work. So this is, contour detection is the very fundament of our sense of vision. So this is one reason to concentrate on it. Another is that in recent years, we and others have tried to describe the development of contour detectors in the brain from a very general and abstract point of view, and it turned out that nevertheless you could make very specific predictions for experiment, that you could reach quantitative agreement with observations. And so I feel that this line of research, which will cover the Bradford, if I'm fortunate, gives an opportunity to think about the role of detailed and general principle in explaining neuroscience problems. And the third reason is that this line of thinking starts to initiate new experimental approaches, new experimental protocols that may eventually settle the questions that that are still open in visual development. Like, for example, it still cannot be ruled out that all of your visual perceptual architecture is determined by genetic information. I don't believe it, but there are no foolproof experiments to disprove this. So the hypothesis keeps popping up from every decade. What actually happens in our visual centers as we learn to see? So why should we think that acquiring the sense of vision has something to do with learning at all? And the basic observation is that in newborn infants or in infant animals, when they are young, the sense of vision is incredibly poor. So if you can recognize this figure, it should be this size for a newborn baby in order, I mean, it will not figure out that this is the European version of the figure one, but to even see it. So the acuity of vision is very bad at birth, and here's the classical data on this. So to the right, you see the age of the subject in months, and on the y-axis, you see the acuity, the visual resolution power, 1/degrees of visual angle, how fine a detail can you dissolve. And there's a steady increase that takes more than half a year to reach something in the order of adult values and covers an order of magnitude at least. So this is an improvement. Is it really learning? The key observation that tells you that this is a learning process that underlies this improvement of perception is that the use of the sense of vision is absolutely required to get that gain in performance. So, for example, if the infant is born with an occluded lens in its eye, so it cannot use its eye to acquire visual information, this improvement does not happen. And so when the first ways to surgically correct occluded lenses were tried out in the 60s, they tried it with adults that had no vision, but restoring the optics of the eye, which was perfectly working well, did not restore vision. These people could not make, the brain of these people could not make sense of visual information at all. So a thing to keep in mind about this gradual improvement, which is dependent on using vision, is that there's this long time scale in here, a time scale of months. How extremely sensitive the infant visual system is to experience was revealed by a very nice experiment by Maurer and co-workers published recently. And they used this phenomenon that one in every 1,000 babies is born with occluded lenses to the advantage that nowadays these babies are, vision is corrected very soon after birth. But in this subject, it is clear when the onset of visual experience is, and you can determine how many hours of visual experience such an infant has. And what they did was to look at one hour of visual experience after surgery, how much was the increase in visual performance at 1 week and 1 month. And so first of all, this shows that this 1 hour makes a measurable difference. Half of an octave of resolving power, and of all the improvement that you could get with 1 month of experience, quite a bit already happened in the first hour. So there is also a very fast time scale there. Now, what happens in the brain as such changes occur? So this is the controls. Infants of the same age-matched infants, of course, there is no. This 1 hour is just a tiny bit of visual experience in comparison to the previous thing, but a month still gets you an improvement.
How is that measured?
You mean how do you make a baby tell you what it can see? So they have found wonderful ways to interrogate babies, what they can see and what they cannot see. But one of the very basic paradigms uses the fact that babies would like to look at stripes. So they should have the Nobel Prize instead of Hubel and Wiesel. So when you expose an infant to two visual displays, one is a pattern of stripes, a grating, and the other a gray display of the same mean luminance, as soon as it can discern the stripes, it will preferentially look to the stripes. So there's another experimentalist behind this wall that does not know what is displayed and just writes down left, right, left, right, left, right. And by the statistics, you can tell whether the infant can tell the difference. Now, they are more complicated. This is a wonderful science in itself. They developed, for example, pacifiers that have circuitry in them that allows the baby, for example, to control the sharpness of a projector, and they will then start to make those images sharp on the screen that they like to look at. And that's the way, for example, it was figured out that babies a few months of age have a preference to look at faces among similar stimuli that are not face-like.
You're talking specifically about the resolving power.
It's just the most basic measure. It's nothing particular.
I mean, what is called visual perception is much, much more than that.
Certainly. Yes. It's just the most well-established measure of visual performance that shows this strong effects and depends on learning-like processes. That's the reason I choose to display this. Yeah?
The time scale is roughly a year.
Yeah.
And if you would compare it, for example, with hearing analysis or being able to stand up, is that all connected with each other?
Good question. Hearing, there's a sequence of these things happening as I learn, as my son grows up. But so hearing is assumed to maturate very fast, much to be in action very early. Also, olfaction is extremely well in newborn babies, and there's another slow increase that follows. So the adults. Resolution is only reached after a few years. But I don't know of any particular pattern that I would come to my mind right now.
Brad,
yeah?
Is it known how much of this improvement is due to the changes in the lens?
It is known that there's a substantial fraction of it in the brain. There's also some improvement by the growth of the eye, the simple thing that the eyeball gets larger also will lead to an improvement, but it does not explain all of the improvement that is exhibited. So, of course, a fascinating question is what happens in the brain as this the sense of vision gets better, and what I will tell you is predictions about what presumably happens, or things that can be predicted about these changes. But what will definitely figure out in the final resolution of these questions is brain imaging as the experimental tool. And in particular, the high-resolution kind that goes under the name of optical imaging and that has become mature in the past decade. This is a method that allows people to determine the overall pattern of activity in a large part of a neural tissue, like the overall pattern of activity of 100,000 cells in a few millimeters times a few millimeters part of the brain. And the basic mechanism by which it works is that the neurons that are active, that fire action potentials, they consume oxygen. So they suck the oxygen from the surrounding blood. In the vicinity of active neurons, there is more deoxygenated hemoglobin, and this produces a change in the spectral properties of the nervous tissue that can be used to find out what are the dark shadows on your brain that go along with the active neurons, because there's the dark venous blood there. So what people do is to present an animal with a stimulus, very often a grating, because this is a very potent stimulus in driving visual cortical cells, and then look which parts of the brain turn dark. Those are the parts that contain the neurons that are activated by the stimulus. And so when did I start actually?
About
20. I don't buy that. So this brings me to the stimulus, brings me to the problem of orientation preference, which was revealed by the classical work of orientation preference by Hubel and Wiesel that finally got them the Nobel Prize. And what they found was that stimuli that have contours in them are very powerful in driving cortical cells, but only if the orientation of the stimulus is right. So if you record from a cortical neuron and change the orientation, say, of the grating that is displayed to the animal, there will be one orientation that elicits the maximum response, the largest number of spikes per time. And if you go away from this preferred orientation, the response becomes less. So there's a selectivity, like the amount of modulation of the firing rate when changing orientation. And an orientation preference of that neuron. And this one prominent application of this method was to figure out how these, so of course different neurons have different preferred orientations. And a fundamental question, how these preferred orientations are laid out across the nervous tissue. And this was finally resolved by Grünwald and Bonhoeffer, which presented the animals with gradings of different orientations, these are the stimuli, and obtained the different activity patterns they evoked. And you can all imagine that you can, by looking at pixel for pixel, you can find out which orientation is it that maximally activates this group of neurons. And the upshot of that is usually displayed in these colorful pictures. So what you do there is to color code the preferred orientation, the orientation that gives the maximum response. And every pixel is a small group of neurons, and the color tells you what is their preferred orientation. Now this is like a 3 by 2 millimeter part of the visual cortex. The entire visual cortex is much larger, like 4 square centimeters in the cat, from which this data is obtained.
And the neuron density?
And what?
The density of neurons?
There are like 100,000 or between 100,000 and a million in such a piece of tissue. An individual neuron is not a small thing, by the way. So a neuron can, has a dendrite that extends over a few hundred micron. So there are two things to keep in mind about these patterns. When you look at these domains, the black domains are all the groups of neurons that respond to, say, this oblique-oriented pattern. They have a typical distance of about a millimeter. So they already contain a large number of neurons. However, the entire pattern is not periodic. It does not exactly repeat. It has this repetitive length scale in it, but it never repeats exactly. And when you look at the pattern of preferred orientations, it is almost everywhere continuous, but remarkably, it is also rich in point defects, and topological point defects of this orientation field. So here is a magnification of one of them. There are singular points in the vicinity of which neurons with all different kinds of preferred orientations are located in a, are organized in a radial, in a circular fashion. So this has, say, chirality 1, and there is an equal number of chirality minus 1 defects. Yeah, and they go under the name of pinwheels because in the in this beautiful color scale, they look like the things you put in your garden and call a pinwheel. So let's briefly scan how the development of this
was discovered experimentally.
This was discovered experimentally. Actually, it was predicted 10 years before by Nick Swindle that there should be a large class of models that should produce such defects. And they were, okay, and there's a, so the experimental record seriously is that in 86 there was an electrophysiological mapping study that really showed that they are there, but it was very laborious to obtain that data, and optical imaging enabled to verify this very effectively and to check all different kinds of inferences on it, and this is the method of choice to reveal these representations in the.
But there was a prediction.
There was a prediction there. There were two predictions. One of Breitenberg in Tübingen, it was that every orientation should be represented twice in the vicinity of the defect. So this was falsified, and the other of Swindle, which predicted so this simplest possible topological charges.
Does the density of defects vary from species to species?
Yeah, that's one of the main things I'm going to talk about. Calculate it for you and then. So how does the development of these features of the brain compare to the development of perception? So for young cats, there's a similar increase in acuity with age. So this is age and days after birth of experimental cats. And when you look at the cortex and simply count the number of synapses that are there, or look how plastic the synapses are, have some measure, I won't go into detail here, that tells you how strong can you change synaptic connections. These are properties, structural properties that vary over this long, over a long time scale of like months. So there's plasticity there at least for 3 months after birth, until 3 months after birth. But when you look at the selectivity of individual neurons, the degree of orientation selectivity, for example, it has a very sharp onset. You don't see the data points, but the curve actually gets it. So it only takes a few hours to go from a cortex that is fairly insensitive to orientation to one in which many people claim orientation selectivity is almost indistinguishable from adult. So on the single neuron level, we don't see much improvement, which implies that if anything is reworked in this brain circuitry over the long time scale of visual improvement, it is not the single neuron selectivity, it is the arrangement of all the columns. While the selectivity is constant, still the individual neurons can change the orientation preferences, and the pattern of orientation preferences can change. So when we realized that, Teogarth and myself, we set out to try to answer the question, what can we in general predict about such rearrangements of the entire pattern of orientation preferences? And in order to predict, you want to minimize the number of assumptions. And the way to do that in physics is to use symmetry assumptions instead of specific modeling assumptions that have biophysical detail in them. So the first blackboard thing I would like to present to you is this analysis of how to calculate how many pinwheels that there are, how many pinwheels there should be, whether they should move, which are all fundamental questions, we believe. So, what? And to do so, to make life as simple as possible, let's adopt the most simple description of this orientation preference map that is conceivable and which was introduced by Swindell, who predicted that there should be topological defects. And it is, okay, for every point in cortex, the location, I tell you a complex number, and that should give you all the information you need in order to specify this orientation field, meaning that the modulus of the complex number C of X, this field, tells you how selective the neurons at the position X are, and its phase tells you the preferred angle. The degree of directivity. This is theta of X. X is a 2D vector because this is a sheet of tissue, only the two spatial dimensions matter. Now if this pattern is reworked by the process of learning to see, it should be C of X and T. T is the age of the animal, and the simplest theory that may describe this is the dynamics for this field C of X and T. Actually, there should be. It may depend on the entire pattern, but it should. So this is the assumption that when I tell you the orientation preference map at day 25 in the cat, there should be a way for you to predict how it looks at day 30.
Presumably F depends on stimulus.
Yeah, of course. All this is hidden in the F. Yeah. And there's an industry of people coming up with their favorite F. Now let's not enter this industry, but make a few structural assumptions about the F. So since no position in the cortex and no direction in the cortical sheet is singled out, this should be symmetric under rotations of the pattern, or translations of the pattern, and rotations of the pattern across the cortex. And another very useful symmetry, and I find also plausible, is that, okay, it should not matter which particular orientation a single neuron chooses to prefer. Rather, differences should matter. And every neuron should eventually be able to choose any orientation. So we can, one way to impose that is that there should be a symmetry with respect to homogeneous shifts of all the orientations. Like that. applying a phase factor to the entire field, which will change all the preferred orientations by the same amount. Now this immediately implies that the anti-reactive state is a fixed point of the dynamics. In any model that has the symmetry, and actually in a larger class, the homogeneous unselective state is a fixed point, and it furthermore implies that if you decompose the dynamics in the power series representation, there's a linear operator on x and z, and there are only odd nonlinearities like third order and so on that can show up.
So you're expanding around the fixed point?
Around this fixed point, yeah. And because what we want to describe is because of the symmetries, all you need to know about this operator is its spectrum, right? It's diagonal in K representation, K space. So all you need to know about it is its eigenvalues. And in order to produce a repetitive pattern with a typical length scale, this spectrum should look like this with a positive eigenvalue, maximum eigenvalue, for the k values that correspond to the wavelength of the pattern, yeah?
Well, the equation, it has time translation.
Yeah.
If you start at age 5 years, like with a baby,
yeah,
it should go exactly the same way.
Yeah.
The f does not depend on t.
Sure.
Should it be so? Why is it so?
Yeah, okay. So what kind of time evolution do you expect from such an equation? This should be a dissipative thing. There are some optimizing whatever the cortex is optimizing. There should be a Lyapunov functional. So eventually, finally,
I thought the question was whether it has to have an explicit dependence on T.
It might have an explicit dependence on T, but the simplest case is if it is constant. And the conclusions I will derive are valid also for T-dependent F. Yeah? So there is
an... There could be other fixed points.
Of course, there should be lots of fixed points. We'll come to that. They should actually look like what people measure in the dark plane, right?
Oh.
What is the initial condition? Early, the neurons are weakly selective for orientations on an appropriate, realistic initial condition is that C of X at time zero is close to this unstable fixed point and is random. If there is no mechanism that can specify the pattern of orientation preference, this is a random thing, and at the very end of the development, the pattern should end up in a factor of this dynamics, or like ground state or in real language. So what happens in between? Well, there's something very general happening in between. I should remove this. If you depict time and the magnitude of the pattern, averaged over space, the typical selectivity of the neurons, there is a first phase in which, due to this instability, selectivity increases exponentially, and this is a purely linear thing because for small c, the linear term dominates. And there's a crossover, and eventually nonlinearities take over and saturate and take the pattern into the attractor. But what happens until this, this time TL, when the dynamics is basically linear, is that these random numbers get reshuffled. So what you have until, as long as the dynamics is linear, is a random field. And from as soon as lots of these random numbers end up mixed together, this would be a Gaussian random field. So we can do something about it. So the simplest thing is, as Tony said, count pinwheels, count these defects. How do we count them? For every defect is a zero of C. So we have to average delta functions of C, and every one of them should contribute the same count. So there should be the Jacobian of C.
Don't you also have anti-pinwheels, things that spin the other way?
Yeah, so this will count both of them, irrespective of the sign.
Sign, I see. But it's not the difference between...
No.
Because in physics, we usually have vortices minus anti-vortices, right?
Yeah.
But this... Yes.
Yeah, other statistics. So, for example, I found out Michael Berry worked a lot about the visual cortex.
This is kind of where the Higgs field vanishes. Right. The magnetic field.
So we want to average this thing over the appropriate ensemble of Gaussian random fields. And then you need to specify this ensemble. I mean, since it's Gaussian, all we need to know is the correlation function of the fields, or equivalently the expectation of the power spectral density P of K. And because we have this Turing instability, the P of K should also have a peak, and it's centered at the typical wavelength. Then, of course, this density is a functional of the power spectral density, P of K. And so after the dust settled, we could establish that it has a lower bound. It's always larger than, pi over lambda square. Well, lambda square is this maximum, the typical wavelength of the pattern, irrespective of the particular form of packs. But we can actually know how many of them are there, irrespective of your choice of model. Now this constraints...
It saturates for pure gasoline.
What?
What is it saturated? The bound is saturated for?
It is saturated if the power spectral density is really a delta function at the typical width.
But now I'm curious, in the real visual cortex, the number of pinwheels and anti-pinwheels are roughly the same.
Yeah,
roughly equal. And this number varies from species to species, but how about from individual to individual?
I'm hesitant to give a definite answer. My impression is in the cat, there's a large variability from individual to individual.
Mm-hmm.
And
I see. There is large variability.
Well, let me put a number there. So all the observed pinwheel densities are between 4 and 2 in this unit. So our minimal initial density lies right in the middle of this range. And there are species, the tupaira, that exhibit, in general, low pinwheel densities, about around 2. This is the entire observed range. Monkeys are up there, have high densities in general. Tupairas, which are kind of shrews, have the lowest density. And cats, in my impression, are all over the place.
Huh.
Yeah.
What are the units?
The units. So there's this dimensionless thing. Pinwheels per lambda square area. So your pattern has a typical wavelength. There's an area associated with it, lambda square. How many defects are in there? This gives you the scale to put it. So, and in shrews there are like 2 of them. There in monkeys there are up to 4, typically 3.7 or so.
2 is not greater than 5.
2 is not exactly. So we have a prediction here, right, that if this kind of theory applies, then where should I? Actually, I wanted to draw it here. So, but there's no space, obviously. I removed this result. You can certainly remember it. So there's this linear time scale, and up to it, we know for sure that whatever the dynamics, the pinwheel density is up here, above 3. No, okay, it's not biologists, above pi. And we have this curious species where there's only 2/3 of pi. So it should be, I mean, the topology should be up here. So either they modify the topology genetically, or they rename it to third spire. And then these creatures, if they learn the orientation maps, the only way to do so is to start out with a high density state and then remove the number, reduce the number of pinwheels, and the only, only way this may happen for topological reasons is by pairwise inhibition.
In tree shrews, I mean, a good proportion of the map is near the boundary.
Yeah.
Doesn't that seem to violate your homogeneity assumption, and therefore maybe you would get a different result if you considered the Gaussian random field independent of where the boundaries were significant?
Yeah. I can't rule it out in principle, but experience from the concrete models and also the fact that there's a stripy region in the shrew visual cortex, which is right in the middle of the area, I wanted to display the data, so maybe I'll do it right now.
So numerical simulations with finite size give the same number roughly?
Yeah. There's no, if you have actual boundaries to the area, I don't know of any model that made a low pinwheel density at the boundary from the beginning. So this picture seems to apply also if you look at the finite domain, but of course it's rigorous only for infinite thing. So of course we contacted these people, the world experts in the topaya, which is happens to be the Fitzpatrick lab, and it's not rolled out. This is very preliminary, this is an orientation map obtained from a day 26 through topaya, and this is almost a grandfather topaya, 77 days old. And what you should really see is there are stripe-like regions like here or like here, and the stripe-like region is a region that has less defects in it, while such clear stripes are absent in the young guy. So one needs to hesitate. This is no proof at all because these are two different animals, but the experiments are underway.
The factor of two came from the old
The two? Why there are two?
No, the two refer to what age?
Two pi.
Maybe
there's
the
okay. Density. I think this is rather the pi than the two pi.
I'm confused about my biology. But on the evolutionary scale, shrews are more advanced than cats, right?
Yeah, there's a lot. For some decade, they were considered actually primates.
Yeah, they are primates, I thought.
No? Then they become non-primates again on the group of their own, maybe.
Oh, they're non-primates.
No. This might be because of animal regulation for experiments. So. To my mind, the shrew is the primate that is as large as a rat. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is not fundamental physics. If this were a problem with fundamental physics, the challenge would be to derive all the products of this reaction and then put the detector around the shrew. But here, since this is beautiful biophysics, you can actually look inside the thing. Yeah? And this will be done shortly. So let's assume this is close to the final state. It is still not a stripe-like pattern. It has lots of defects in it. So the theoretical...
More than pi.
Yeah. Not more than pi over 2.
So this is less than pi.
This is less than pi, but more than 0, right? If you really want to stick to that picture, there should be models with attractors that have quite a few pinwheels in them. And so if you are most radical, you would like to find a model in which has aperiodic solutions with a typical length scale and the right density of pinwheels. And so this is a problem that puzzles a fraction of the participants of the neural program, and I would like to spend the last fraction of this talk lining out a few approaches how you can build a field theory with stable pinwheels. And how much space do I need for this? So one approach that is advocated by Dmitry Shlovsky, back there, let's speak about learning and this stuff. When you put a few neurons in a dish and you feed them right, they will start to establish connections. For example, an axon going from this guy to this guy, and you may imagine they go baroque all over the place, but what happens in fact is that finally, if they are connected, it looks like this. So you may read an optimum principle from this simple dish experiment that these guys like to have their wires short. And what Mitya advocates is to take this observation into the brain and say, well, let's look what patterns you find that have minimum, that allow the neurons to be very optimally wired.
I'm confused by your picture. Yeah? I thought the connection can only go from one neuron to another. What is that trifurcation?
an axon. So that one neuron in the brain connects to 1,000 other neurons. And it has only one axon that goes out and then splits into different branches that go out to the other guys.
I see, splits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it makes a lot of sense to stick to the hypothesis that one should optimize on the wiring, because much of the brain is made of wires. I mean, to give you numbers, if you look at a cube millimeter of cortex tissue, there's a kilometer of wires in there. So it appears desirable to keep them short. Let me try to present you the qualitative flavor of this theory. So what you have to specify is the wiring diagram of the neurons. So if you are a neuron of this preferred orientation on the axis of preferred orientations, for some reason, you may be required to establish connections to two guys with other orientation preferences. So there should be some histogram, for example, like this, which would mean that you should connect to neurons of like orientations. So interrupt me if I get you wrong. There may be another situation in which the neuron is required to make contacts to other guys of all different orientations. Now, all of you can find out what the optimal layouts are for these two cases. Here, you have to connect only to close by orientations, and to do that effectively, it is very efficient to have stripes of different preferred orientations. So, in any circle, there are guys of similar orientations, and there's no circle that has the odd guys in it. If you have to connect to all of them, it is very efficient to have a salt and pepper. I fail to really be able to have salt and pepper patterns. But in here, if you draw a little circle, there are neurons for all your needs in there. And you can imagine that, okay, since these are the two extremes, there should be wiring diagrams in between that require quite a bit of continuity, but also diversity in close distance that get you optimal fields that have defects in them, because in the vicinity of the defect, you can satisfy those connection requirements, but by the continuity, it is easy to make lots of connections to similar guys. Another idea was brought into this by Niran Kada, and is based on being puzzled about this third symmetry. So this symmetry, let's imagine I had colored chalk, something. So. Let's imagine two neurons in your brain, and they are distant from each other, so they look at different parts of the visual field. This being the visual field, the field orientations may be like this, or maybe like this, or maybe like this. Huh? So this guy looking there, or there, and this guy looking there, preferring this and that orientation. And as long as the symmetry applies, all these configurations are considered equivalent. Now this is not really plausible, totally plausible, because a columnar pair of contours is perceived differently from a parallel pair of contours. There are different perceptual interactions in adult vision, and one may wonder what happens to this picture as you go from this symmetry to a symmetry that allows for this. Now the symmetry that allows for such interactions is whenever you choose to rotate receptive fields, you should also rotate the space by the same angle, so that columnar interactions are always mapped onto columnar configurations. This linear operator has eigenfunctions e to the I kx. Let's consider only the x axis for a second. So only k vectors that point along the x axis. It did so because it has also eigenfunctions cosine kx x and I sine kx x that are degenerate. Now if you leave this symmetry in favor of this degeneracy will typically be lifted. And you can imagine a situation where now the eigenvalue of the cosine component in x direction is unstable, but that of the sine component of the imaginary part is stable. By virtue of this combined symmetry, then in the y direction, you have the inverse. So it's easy to build a model in which there are plane waves in the x direction of the real part and plane waves in the y direction of the imaginary part, and this gives you a square lattice of defects. So it might, this suggests that maybe this columnar interactions have something to do with the stabilization of defects. Do you agree?
Yep.
Okay, what else? I mean, these are fairly specific assumptions. Maybe there's a similar way.
When you look at that, the defects there, yeah, they form a lattice.
Sure, it's a square lattice. Thank you. it's a fair question, and it's a very fascinating. If you want to take it to the extreme, there should be aperiodic solutions, aperiodic ground states in such a model. So how can we build such a thing? And a way to do that is to start from yet another principle. Can I write about this? I have to, I fear. Which is to say it is forbidden to be orientation blind. Huh? No orientation blindness, please. No. If you want to have a model that describes how vision gets better, it should not become blind to the orientations, to some orientations. But there is still a serious danger of that happening because, I mean, this is since this is an optimization problem, all the coefficients in the F are real. So plug in the real field here, it will always stay a real field, which means that there is quite a number of real-valued solutions also. And they don't go away by this qualitative feature of the dynamics. So what you have to require of any reasonable candidate is that all these real-valued solutions are not attractors, that they are unstable. So how can we build a model in which every real-valued solution is unstable? There's one class of models in which you can address this question in general is if the maximum eigenvalue of this operator lambda, which is now gone, and here the typical size of C, if this is a second order transition, if it is a continuous bifurcation from the homogeneous state to the actual pattern. Then you can perturbatively treat this problem around the critical point, and making an ansatz that the solution should be approximately a composition of a finite number n of Fourier modes on the critical circle, all the k vectors in here should be on the critical circle, which is typically fulfilled in the vicinity of the transition. And you can work out what the equations for these amplitudes will eventually be to the right hand side of the transition. And they look in general like this. There's a familiar part, Landau-like equation, that is insensitive to the phases of the ARs. Oops. Two more things in one here. But there's also another part that is sensitive to the phases. And you can use this approximation in the vicinity of the critical point in order to study the fixed points and their stability. And this doesn't work anymore.
It's a boring
problem. Yeah. It's a burdening process, I would say. And it turns out, will be another seminar, that if you require the two inequalities, GII being larger than GII plus M over 2, and RDF coefficients being larger than 0, that guarantees for you that all the real-valued solutions are unstable. And the mechanism is very simple. If you have so these inequalities mean that if you have an amplitude C of a K vector present in the decomposition of the pattern, this implies that the amplitude for the inverse K vector must vanish. So these inequalities mean rules for the interaction of these different amplitudes that make, if there's some component at K, there must be no component at minus K, and since the real valued field has C of K is the conjugate of C of minus K, these solutions are then guaranteed to be complex. Now let me conclude by...
This is the
space between the two hemispheres.
Oh, okay.
This is a large blood vessel. So here's a collection of the potentially stable solutions of this brand of model. Mm-hmm. You can enumerate them by the number of active modes you allow, and the game is obviously when you put a wave factor here, there must not be a wave factor there. So there's, as you increase the number of wave factors n, there's a combinatorial multiplicity of patterns you can build. And these high n guys, they look pretty much like many measurements. So, and since we can enumerate all of them, we can send our computer to calculate the densities. And this is the density of these families as a function of family index. So the higher the index, the more family members you have. And in this, between 10 and 20, we fill the interval between 2 and 3.5 very continuously. So this was really very pleasing when I first realized it. Sebastian. Yeah.
And why is
M? These are the ground states consistent with your rules and, for quartic approximation to the model.
Yeah, exactly. They are good approximations only in the vicinity of the
So you just allowed all the terms allowed by the symmetry in the vicinity of the fixed point.
Yeah.
I mean, the vicinity of the
pardon? Okay. So what should I?
And the fact that the density of Pringles is a vertical band is because of the randomness you put in.
So there's no randomness. For n equals 15, there are 612 different patterns that are not related by symmetries.
Oh, I see.
So these are the 612 different Pringle densities
so
of these patterns.
Each kind of Pringle density for each one of the patterns.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, there's a randomness if you choose the phases, for example. But that's averaged out here.
Okay.
So all these, mostly these were determined up to the second significant digit, and then we stopped to count more pinwheels.
And this is agrees with the observed density as
that's the claim,
varying over different species, right?
The Schulz happen to build things down here. The cats don't care. The monkeys stay up there.
I see. Okay.
But they seem more to choose from a similar repertoire.
Okay.
600 templates, presumably every picture that you come up with, you can find one.
that's a project. It would be more simple than directly estimate the model from the data. So you can then start to understand what kind of interactions are really needed to have these realistic patterns stable. But in order to demonstrate that we can actually make different biology using these concepts, I would like to end with something else.
No orientation blindness calculation, what symmetries did you assume?
These three.
So what happens if you include the
What happens is, this band of model is not sensitive to breaking this symmetry in favor of this. There might be a transition as you really have a strong broken symmetry here, but it's not sensitive to going from that symmetry to this symmetry. So, of course, the Schulz data speak only to the fact that will eventually speak to the fact of whether these intermediate Gaussian states are stable or decay. But the conceptual question about the late things is whether they are actually attractors. And in order to assess this experimentally, what one would need to do is to offset this pattern from its present state and then assess whether it will return to the same thing, or since there's quite a number of such maps, whether it may end up in a different basin of attraction. And believe it or not, a friend of us recently ran into a protocol to do just that. So what Grobe and Dinsel in Bochum did was the simplest possible manipulation you can imagine. They put an electrode into one of these columns and fed it for about an hour impulses that made a local population of neurons fire, and assess the map before and after, and which is most interesting, a few hours after this experiment.
Huh.
And so they were already surprised that they could induce changes by such a simple manipulation, and by the fact that these changes extended over the entire field of view they choose. So there are reorganizations of the preferred orientation induced by the stimulation 2 millimeters apart from the stimulation site, while they are sure that they only activate a local group of neurons. Now, when they follow the resulting state over many hours, there are qualitatively two kinds of outcomes. One you may call true recovery, in which So you have this deformed map, but it returns to something fairly similar to the initial state. But there is also what you may call progressive rearrangement. While you stop stimulating, the pattern keeps changing and ends up in a different shape after a few hours of spontaneous activity.
And one of the better quantitative ways of
measuring them. We're working on that. Yeah, so there's still an order of magnitude in signal to noise lacking, but this may have been solved recently.
So eventually there'll be a machine we can stick our head in.
Brain design. Yeah, that's what we're after. Yeah, have a different map every year.
Do people see better outcome in the progressive rearrangement? Is there some measure of that?
It's a good question. We don't know. There are protocols to make an adult. So these are adult animals, by the way. So there's still plasticity in the adults.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just one of the proofs that there's plasticity in the adults. There are other protocols in humans. For example, Misha has presented recently a very nice study that showed that in human perception you can teach people to view better in particular parts of the visual space. And the changes, the neural changes that go along with such perceptual learning, as it is called, are really opaque. There are more obvious changes that were easily detected, and maybe they are on the level of maps, I don't know, but it can't be ruled out that it's a rearrangement of the maps that goes along with perceptual learning in the adult. So I think I almost made it in an hour, and thanks so much for your attention.
Thank you.